Soleimani looks tempting. Comes on a bed of spinach. Can you hold that? No, then I'll have the chicken fried sanctions. Or, here's an even better idea. If you didn't want her to pick it, don't give it as an option. It's like your boyfriend saying, wait, why did you choose breakup? I only put that on there so you'd be more into the threesome idea. Which obviously is a joke. So, why did Trump choose what the Pentagon saw as the most extreme option? Well, Trump says he had no choice.
Last night, at my direction, the United States military successfully executed a flawless precision strike that killed the number one terrorist anywhere in the world, Qasem Soleimani. Soleimani was plotting imminent and sinister attacks on American diplomats and military personnel, but we caught him in the act and terminated him.
Okay, imminent attack. But the Pentagon said that the strike was carried out to deter future attacks. So what was the imminent threat? Eventual threats. It's like that old vaudeville routine, who's on first? Kill him. Kill who? Yes. According to officials who were briefed on the strike, the evidence about an imminent threat was razor thin. Okay, so a new dangerous conflict in the Middle East launched by the U.S. government on a murky premise with razor thin evidence. You know what that means? 2003 is back, baby. In 17 years, we've come full circle. From yellow cake to chocolate cake. From WMD to KFC. From shock and awe to shockingly awful.
As much as we insult the Trump administration, at least they're learning from America's previous mistakes. Yeah. Because in 2003, the Bush administration had a plan to go into Iraq, but no exit strategy. So now the Trump administration is like, ah, I see where we went wrong. This time, no entrance strategy. Lesson learned.
After the attack, Fox News decided to turn to their stable of lumpy white guys who've been wrong about everything, like Lindsey Graham, a champion of the Iraq War, and former Bush officials and serial liars Ari Fleischer and Karl Rove. Why are these the best experts we can get? This is like doing a segment on organizing music festivals and interviewing Billy McFarlane and Ja Rule. And the same people are trotting out the same lies they did 17 years ago. For example, Vice President Mike Pence lied and tried to link Soleimani to 9/11 in a tweet that was not supported by the evidence. And if that sounds familiar to you, it's because it's right out of the playbook of George W. Bush and Donald Rumsfeld, who repeatedly linked Saddam Hussein to al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups without providing any evidence.
The reason I keep insisting that there was a relationship between Iraq and Saddam and al-Qaeda, because there was a relationship between Iraq and al-Qaeda.
There are reports that there is no evidence of a direct link between Baghdad and some of these terrorist organizations.
The reports that say there's that something hasn't happened are always interesting to me, because as we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know.
Excuse me, but is this an unknown unknown? Several unknowns, and I'm just wondering
not
this
going,
is an unknown
I'm not going to say which it is.
Oh, you're not going to say? So it's unknown whether it's an unknown unknown. But one known that we do know is what Trump knows, which is a known unknown, because he unknows what he doesn't know, meaning we know he knows no knowns. It's amazing. It's amazing that we found a way to elect people who think these guys had the right idea. So Pence lied, just like Bush and Rumsfeld lied, but hey, at least this isn't the first time Mike Pence has been wrong about a disastrous war in the Middle East.
I am here to report, as the United States military confirmed in Iraq on Monday, weapons of mass destruction have been found in Iraq.
It's fitting that 16 years later, Pence is telling the same lies, because 16 years later, he looks the exact same. I mean, I'm pretty sure he's just a stock photo businessman come to life. When he takes off his shirt, it says Getty Images across his chest. So the Trump administration tried to link Soleimani to 9/11. They also claimed they were stopping an imminent threat. But if that's true, they haven't presented any evidence of that threat to Congress or the public. In fact, a New York Times reporter tweeted that the evidence for such a threat was razor thin. And the Times also wrote that national security experts and even other officials at the Pentagon said they were unaware of anything drastically new about Iranian behavior in recent weeks.
The death of Qasem Soleimani in Baghdad ignited a new chapter of regional tensions. American allies in the region are preparing for possible retaliation and are on high alert. So are American forces, with 9,000 in the region and 3,000 extra preparing to deploy.
The State Department issued an urgent warning overnight telling all Americans in Iraq to leave the country immediately.
The Pentagon announced that the U.S. has paused its efforts in the fight against ISIS due to a need to protect U.S. troops in the region.
Iraq's parliament voted to kick out the 5,000 U.S. troops in the country. President Trump fired back, telling reporters if Iraq does force U.S. troops to leave, he'll make Iraq pay for money the United States spent in Iraq to build an expensive airbase. We're not leaving unless they pay us back for it, he said.
Okay, guys, I don't know, but I think it's safe to say that this thing's not going according to plan. Because you realize now, America is sending more troops to the Middle East. And also, how is Trump going to flat out refuse to leave someone else's country? Right? He would be the worst Airbnb tenant of all time. Yeah, just writing a review like, I burned myself cooking meth in your kitchen, so I'm not leaving until you give me my money back. So now, because of Trump's extreme decision, the world is in a state of panic. Because, like, the truth is, no one really knows what's gonna happen next. Nobody. We could be on the brink of war, World War III, or the whole thing could just fizzle out, like the beef between Nick Cannon and Eminem. Yeah, a lot of people don't know, but Jared Kushner actually brokered that peace deal. Yeah, he does stuff. So we don't know what's gonna happen. But the question on everyone's mind is, why would Donald Trump even bring everybody to this point? Why do something so risky? Why now? Nobody knows. If only there was a wise man, some wise man in 2011 who could have predicted why this would be happening today.
Our president will start a war with Iran because he has absolutely no ability to negotiate. He's weak and he's ineffective. So the only way he figures that he's going to get reelected, and as sure as you're sitting there, is to start a war with Iran. I believe that he will attack Iran sometime prior to the election because he thinks that's the only way he can get elected. Isn't it pathetic?
Republican Senator Rand Paul said the killing of Soleimani is the death of diplomacy with Iran.
You would have to be brain dead to believe that we tear up the agreement, we put an embargo on you, and we kill your major general, and they're just going to crawl back to the table and say, what do you want, America?
Excuse me, Senator? How dare you suggest that America's president is brain dead? That is so insulting. Mr. President, why don't you go ahead and educate this fool?
President Trump defended himself on Monday, saying the United States is a lot safer now.
We'll see what happens. We'll see what the response is, if any. But you've seen what I said our response will be.
The Trump administration is scrambling to explain the two words that led to all of this. Imminent threat.
Was the justification this imminent threat?
Chuck, it's never one thing. You've been at this a long time. The American people are smart, too. It's never one moment. It's never one instance. It's a collective. It's a full situational awareness of risk.
If you're looking for imminence, you need to look no further than the days that led up to the strike that was taken against Soleimani.
When you say the attacks were imminent, how imminent were they? Were we talking about days? Were we talking about weeks?
If you're an American in the region, days and weeks, this is not something that's relevant.
You can't say the threat is imminent. Then when people ask how imminent, you're like, well, time is irrelevant. No, because that's specifically what imminent means. Like, he's acting like we're crazy for asking a question. An attack was imminent, okay? It's like, really, Pompeo? How imminent? Jeez, you guys are obsessed with numbers. Get off my back, Rain Man. So America is on the cusp of war. And already, the most basic question, why are we doing it, has been unclear at best. But the fallout has been handled just as clumsily.
So things are bad with Iran, but don't you worry. Things are also bad with Iraq. On Sunday, Iraq's parliament voted to expel American troops. So, Iraq said get out, And the Pentagon was like, okay.
Yesterday, the U.S. government made two stunning announcements in the span of a couple of hours. First, they were withdrawing its troops from Iraq. And second, forget that thing that we first just said.
Adding to the confusion Monday, the Pentagon circulated a letter announcing a withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq. But the Pentagon later said there is no decision to leave Iraq, and it was just a draft.
It was a mistake, an honest mistake.
That's like saying, honey, that breakup email was from my drafts folder. Now, as I was saying, with this ring, I thee wed.
Yeah, that's right. The Pentagon released an announcement saying they were pulling out the troops, and then they were like, backsies. I didn't take my hand off the piece. That's not the move. Like, how do you send out a draft military announcement by mistake? These people control nuclear weapons, and they can't even handle Microsoft Outlook. How do you do this, huh? They're like, all right, it's time to bomb Iran. Oh, I sent them a referral code to Grubhub. Sorry, guys.
While the Middle East is getting all the headlines, there are also some smaller, quirky local news stories you may have missed. For instance, the president of the United States was impeached. We thought impeachment would be all we'd be talking about in 2020. When we left for the holidays, the House had just impeached Donald Trump. As soon as that was over, Senate Republicans were raring to get the articles of impeachment so they could whip through their trial. No witnesses, no evidence, no eye contact, no kissing, cash on the dresser, lock the door on your way out. But then, Nancy Pelosi decided to withhold the articles of impeachment from the Senate until Mitch McConnell agreed on parameters of a trial that she views as fair. So what outrageous demands does Nancy have for the trial? Well, first up, witnesses. And there's a chance she might actually get one now because we got an update from former National Security Advisor John Bolton. Bolton was at the center of the Ukraine scandal and famously called Trump's decision to withhold aid in exchange for political favors a drug deal. Yes, a drug deal. This is like Breaking Bad, except there's no Walter and everyone is white. Now, back during the House impeachment hearings, investigators wanted Bolton to testify, and he said, nah. But yesterday, he put out this statement. If the Senate issues a subpoena for my testimony, I am prepared to testify. Oh, how courageous to volunteer for something we all know is never going to happen.
In every trial that there has ever been in the Senate regarding impeachment, witnesses were called. The big problem I have, if we don't get to call meaningful witnesses, direct witnesses to the point, is that you're basically changing impeachment. Impeachment in the House is not the trial. When you have a witness who was there, who was engaged in it, who was in the middle of it, telling you about what they were doing and why, it's a totally different case.
Thanks for the song this week from
Edwin Starr. Oh no. Golden Earring.
And thanks also to
Rod Serling, Rudy Giuliani, Winston Smith, Brooke Baldwin, Hugh Hewitt, Stephen Colbert, Russ Cargill,
and President
Schwarzenegger,
Jimmy
Kimmel,
George W.
Bush,
Donald
Rumsfeld, Richard Engel,
Rand
Paul, Chuck Todd, Mike Pompeo, Jake Tapper, Lindsey Graham.
Preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.
Sharon Jones of Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, and you're tuned to WGXC 90.7 FM Egg Rock. Come on, y'all, get funked up, get sold up, get on down with the sound of the town.
WGXC always needs computer donations. If you have an old one you don't need, and it's either a Macintosh 2011 or newer 2.0 gigahertz or faster CPU, dual core or more, or Windows 2012 or newer, 2.4 gigahertz or faster CPU, dual core or more, email info at WGXC.org for more information.
Wavefarm programs are made possible in part by the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of Governor Andrew Cuomo and the New York State Legislature, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts, the Greene County Legislature through the County Initiative Program administered in Greene County by the Greene County Council on the Arts, the Alexander and Marjorie Hoover Foundation, the Foundation for Contemporary Arts, the T. Backer Fund, the Joseph Family Charitable Trust, and hundreds of other generous individual donors.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Wendy Schmaltz of Claverick, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
You are tuned to 90.7 FM, WGXC. Like good old tap water. Just turn it on and get it.
Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson calls out Trump's lies on Iran. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. President Donald Trump brought the United States to the brink of war with Iran by ordering the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani, the second most powerful figure in Iran. After Soleimani and four others were killed in a U.S. drone strike at Baghdad International Airport Friday, Trump, offering no evidence, alleged Soleimani was orchestrating imminent attacks on American personnel. We should be skeptical when Trump or any leader invokes secret intelligence to justify their violent actions. Perhaps no one knows this better than Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who served as Secretary of State Colin Powell's chief of staff from 2002 to 2005. He witnessed and participated in the effort by President George W. Bush, Vice President Dick Cheney, and others to promote lies to justify the disastrous illegal invasion of Iraq in 2003. In a New York Times editorial in 2018, headlined, "I Helped Sell the False Choice of War Once, It's Happening Again," Colonel Wilkerson wrote, "That effort led to a war of choice with Iraq, one that resulted in catastrophic losses for the region and the United States-led coalition, and that destabilized the entire Middle East." He continued, "The Trump administration is using much of the same playbook to create a false impression that war is the only way to address the threats posed by Iran. This war with Iran would be 10 to 15 times worse than the Iraq war in terms of casualties and costs," Wilkerson said. Back in 2003, Colonel Wilkerson helped Secretary of State General Colin Powell prepare his infamous February 5, 2003 speech before the United Nations Security Council.
"My colleagues, every statement I make today is backed up by sources, solid sources. These are not assertions. What we're giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence."
Powell's presentation included numerous slides, audio clips, and a sample vial purportedly containing anthrax, which Powell gingerly held aloft for the cameras. The speech lasted over 2 hours and, it turns out, was riddled with lies and fabrications. Powell would later describe his performance as a permanent blot on his record. But it did the job. 6 weeks later, shock and awe began. The Bush-Cheney administration indiscriminately bombed Iraq.
All across the region, the chaos that we're looking at was produced by the United States invasion in 2003.
That's Colonel Wilkerson speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour this week.
I watched as the intelligence was cooked, as principals in the George W. Bush government were sold by that intelligence or helped to warp that intelligence, as was the case with Dick Cheney. And I watched the inevitable march to war.
Among the similarities that Wilkerson sees between the lies that led to war in 2003 and today are Trump's surrogates appearing on TV, or now Twitter, lying to the public. Vice President Mike Pence tweeted after the assassination that Soleimani, quote, assisted in the clandestine travel to Afghanistan of 10 of the 12 terrorists who carried out the September 11th terrorist attacks in the United States.
Pence's words in particular are laughable,
said Colonel Wilkerson.
Soleimani and his entourage were actually helping us in Afghanistan in 2001, early 2002, to fight the Taliban. We got indispensable help from Iran in that regard.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has been one of the most vocal and omnipresent defenders of Trump's assassination of Soleimani. Wilkerson continues,
we are going to lie, cheat, and steal, as Pompeo is doing right now, as Trump is doing right now, as Esper is doing right now, as Lindsey Graham is doing right now, as Tom Cotton is doing right now, and a host of other members of my political party, the Republicans, are doing right now. We are going to cheat and steal to do whatever it is we have to do to continue this war complex. That's the truth of it, and that's the agony of it.
Colonel Wilkerson is not the only Republican critical of Trump's actions. This is Utah Republican Senator Mike Lee responding to the Trump administration briefing of Congress on Wednesday.
The briefing lasted only 75 minutes, whereupon our briefers left. This, however, is not the biggest problem I have with the briefing, which I would add was probably the worst briefing I've seen, at least on a military issue, in the 9 years I've served in the United States Senate. What I found so distressing about that briefing was that one of the messages we received from the briefers was, do not debate, do not discuss the issue of the appropriateness of further military intervention against Iran. And that if you do, you'll be emboldening Iran. The implication being that we would somehow be making America less safe by having a debate or a discussion about the appropriateness of further military involvement against the government of Iran. Now, I find this insulting and demeaning, not personally, but to the office that each of the 100 senators in this building happens to hold. I don't care whether they're with the CIA, with the Department of Defense, or otherwise, to come in and tell us that we can't debate and discuss the appropriateness of military intervention against Iran. It's un-American. It's unconstitutional, and it's wrong.
Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who's witnessed the war makers behind closed doors firsthand, is not optimistic about the prospects for peace.
Ever since 9/11, the beast of the national security state, the beast of endless wars, the beast of the alligator that came out of the swamp, for example, and bit Donald Trump just a few days ago, is alive and well. America exists today to make war.
I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Yeah, for some reason or another, you sound a little taller on radio.
All right, now we've got Tom DiPietro, the Hudson Common Council president, on the line to preview the next Hudson Common Council meeting, which is Monday night?
Monday night at 7 p.m., the informal meeting. Every month we begin with on the first Monday of the month, I'm sorry, the second Monday of the month, we have the informal meeting in which we invite more public comment. And then on the third Tuesday is the formal meeting where we actually vote on resolutions and laws that were introduced at the informal meeting. Does that make sense?
Yes. So if you're a member of the public, the informal meeting is more important to...
Yeah, it is, because it's more open and there's more room for discussion with the public.
So you can bring an issue to the council's attention.
Correct. So anybody out there who would like to see the council working on something, come on by. You know, we love to hear from you.
And what are you going to be working on this Monday?
Well, we'll begin with just our organizational meeting, which happens at the beginning of every year. This is our first meeting of 2020. And that at the organizational meeting, we go over the rules of order. There are a couple of revisions we've made. We have a new city attorney for the council. I'm sorry. You may have read that the city attorney's office is now a group of five people who are all going to be handling different aspects of legal aspects of city work. The attorney for the council, Jeff Baker, is new to the council, and he and I went over the rules of order last week, and we came up with some small fixes here and there, a couple things that were unclear by the rules of order, and that's one thing we're going to be doing. And also, I appoint all the new committees. Now, there's not a great amount of change because we only have three new council members this term, which is a good thing. It means a lot of continuity. So everybody will get their appointments on what committees they serve. And that's important because committees are where the work begins. You know, resolutions or laws begin in a committee. The committees more or less craft the resolution, then the resolution comes to the full council. So that's a big part of the organizational meeting. After that, we begin the actual informal meeting. And a couple of things, I'd say the biggest thing is we're going to reintroduce the moratorium on short-term rentals with a slight revision. The earlier version that was vetoed at the end of 2019 looked for a 9-month moratorium. This time we're going to only go for 7, which is sort of makes up for the month we've lost. And it's more or less a sure thing at this point.
Because of the change in the council?
The change in the council and, of course, the change in the mayor. The mayor is fully supportive of it.
He won't veto it, and then you don't have the votes to overturn the veto, or you don't need the votes then. Yeah.
We don't need the votes to overturn the veto, and if we had to, we have them. So there's a greater consensus. Some people have called it a team, but I think, or a slate. What we have now is a real coalition that I think agrees on more issues than previously. So that will get back in action. And then while that moratorium is happening or being discussed, we will also try to come up with the final regulation for short-term rentals. And as you know, as someone who follows the news, everyone's dealing with this. Rhinebeck just had enacted some rules and are getting a lot of pushback. And so we watch what other municipalities are doing.
Chatham has talked about it. Germantown, I think, has talked about it.
A lot of places have talked about it. Rhinebeck actually put in a rule. So that's, when you see other municipalities actually enacting laws and regulations, that gives you a template or, an idea of what works and what doesn't work.
I think Woodstock recently passed a law, too.
I'll check theirs, too. And, of course, the most dramatic one regionally was Jersey City, which just basically had an outright ban completely. I mean, we're not going to go in that direction, but partly because we're going to grandfather in most of the people who have already started with their short-term rentals. And, the majority are just people who are renting a room or an apartment in their own buildings. And no one wants to hurt them because they're often people just helping to finance their own tax payments and things like that. It's the outside investors. And some of them, believe me, are most predatory. I mean, they're buying up buildings, doing minor renovations, and then completely using them for short-term rentals with no daily stake in the city of Hudson. These are outside investors who really are just here to make money.
So that you're sort of targeting that sort of B and B person rather than the mom and pop just has an extra room.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's, you know, and it's good that we've done that because those, the mom and pop, as you put it, are the ones who feel the most threatened. And once we made it clear to them they're not threatened, they, I think, actually support the larger idea of keeping outside investors to a minimum.
And how do you think this will play in the overall housing picture? Because this is just like one piece of the there's less inventory because of rentals. There's not enough hotel rooms, which is another issue. There's not enough lower income housing places. So how does this fit in with all that?
Well, it's a small piece but it's a significant piece because every time a short-term rental goes into effect, that is to say, someone takes a normal rental apartment off the rental, the long-term rental rules, that means, you know, you can't completely assess what that means, but it definitely means one rentable apartment has ceased to exist for, an annual lease. And that not only means, it may not mean a affordable unit, but even if you take a market rate unit off, it still affects the larger marketplace for rental units. There's no disputing that. If you have 10 rentals for long-term rents, and you take one off the market, obviously the 9 remaining have an incentive to raise their rent. So, you know, will it address the affordable issue? No. But we have other things that I think are going to happen to help do that. And, of course, if you followed last December or November, I should say, we made a great effort to enable Bliss Towers to renovate 25 of their units that are completely uninhabited right now. So that's definitely in the affordable range. So the long-term plan is to create more housing, but, you know, you got to do it carefully. You can't just put up ugly buildings that everybody's going to object to. You have to deal with a lot of input from the community and make sure that it's not, you know, just a something that's going to go into disrepair or something that doesn't have any long-term benefit.
And so this is just one part of that, council has plans to sort of address other parts of the issue?
What's so great is that right now, because of the coalition I spoke of, both the council, the mayor, and even the Hudson Housing Authority, all seem to be on the same page for once. It's been a while. I mean, it's hard to build this kind of coalition that agrees about how to get housing, you know, developed. If we could just get the Hudson Development Corps on the same page, we'd really be. I mean, that would be, you know, heaven for the city, because they have one of the larger properties available that can be developed, the old CAS building that you might be familiar with.
Ah, yes.
So it looks good. I mean, it's a slow process, but I think we're getting there. And, of course, there's always that mystery player, the Galvin Foundation, and they have lots of properties, and some of them are developable as rental buildings. And so we have to sit and watch what they're up to. They talk to us. But you never can, they're a private entity, so you can't really force them to do or not do anything.
And they own a lot of the housing stock in the city, so they are a major component in this whole affordable housing crisis.
Exactly. They have upwards of 80 properties somewhere around there. It keeps changing. Some they sell off. They acquire new ones. So we don't really, it's hard to keep track of everything they do because, you know, it's not. One of the things I've discovered in municipal government is part of it is just tracking the real estate that goes on here, because real estate is really, people talk about tourism being the engine for Hudson's economy, but it's real estate. There's so much turnover. And I was talking to our new assessor the other day, and she acknowledged that Hudson, unlike a lot of the other municipalities around here, the turnover is so great. The market is so volatile. In the sense of, buying and selling constantly, that it's hard to keep abreast of it, but it does turn out to be a part of what municipal government's all about.
Yeah, and it seemed to be the main issue in the election last year, right?
One of, yeah, exactly. especially when it came to, as you know, the assessment, the overall revaluation
right.
that was usually controversial.
That went up 3,000% for some people or something like that, or 300%?
300% for me.
So 300%, not 3,000. But we're veering off of the what's going on in the meeting this Monday. What else? Are there other issues you're going to tackle?
We're going to start to there's a couple of other local laws we'd like to get in the works. But because none of the committees can meet until Monday's meeting, because it's not,
without the organizational meeting?
Without the organizational meeting. But I can tell you that on the legal committee, where the legal committee is going to be a lot of things happening, not only the short-term rental regulation, but we're going to relook at the lodging tax law, which, as you may know, designated a significant percentage of the money we take in from the lodging tax to a tourism board. Now, there's a nice figure of money, a rather large amount of money, sitting there in a dedicated account that we can't touch because it's by law defined as having to go to marketing, whatever that exactly means. But we'd like to get rid of that designation. In other words, in the future, lodging tax, when it's taken in, just goes into the general fund like any other local source of revenue. It was kind of a mistake of the people of the original lodging tax dedicated that. But it was, there was a very vocal group of B&B owners and others who were pushing for, that the tax had to be dedicated to the tourism business. And that's just bad policy. So we're going to try to change that through the legal committee. And there's, we'll see what else bubbles up as we go along. The budgeting for this year went pretty well. As a member of the BEA, the budget committee, for sure, we'll call it, because it has another board of estimate and I forget the other word, but it's the mayor, myself as common council president, and the treasurer. And, we set it up pretty well. Well, we have a good budget going into the year. We didn't over plan, that is to say that we're going to get revenue from certain things that's way out of whack with what's possible. Some little minor changes. I think what we want to do is lower the amount of time you get for your quarter on Warren Street.
What do you get, 2 hours now?
You get an hour for 25 cents. So if we lower that, it's not so much to raise more revenue, though it will, but the real idea is to incentivize people to use the parking lots behind Warren Street. Those won't go up in price. So, because, the Warren Street traffic, it just gets so congested. And a lot of people are willing to feed meters at 25 cents for an hour. And, they'll feed them all day. And that's just not good for Warren Street. It's not good for the businesses there. It's not good for anyone, really.
And so the numbered streets won't have the price increase, but just Warren Street?
Correct.
And that it seems like that's mainly targeted at people, literally, like you say, running out and putting quarters in and running back in. They won't be able to do that.
Right. The idea is, you should, since it is.
Or they still can, but it'll be more difficult.
They still can, but it'll be a lot more difficult, and they have a bigger stack of quarters waiting for them. So those are some of the kinds of things. We're also going to look at the entire, as one of the things I'm doing this year is I'm going to actually chair one of the committees, and that's the Finance Committee, because the Finance Committee not only looks at what we spend, but also is constantly looking for new sources of revenue. And one of the things that I asked the last Finance Committee to do, and they never really seemed to get around to it, was to look at our fee schedule. Our fee schedule is really out of whack with other municipalities of an equal size, and everything from what you pay to have your building plans or renovation plans approved by the code officer to, we have some things we don't even charge for. Like if you have a site plan review by the planning board, which, costs money to do because it has to go through the code enforcement officer, and that takes them a lot of time, we charge nothing for that. So we're going to look at all the fees we charge and see where we can enhance some of the revenue that way. And these are the normal costs of, municipal things that people do in the city. Everything from building permits to dog permits to, you name it. wedding permits, you know, I mean, wedding licenses. So we're going to look at that entire schedule. And not only that, once we do it, unlike other municipalities, we don't have a single page on our website that tells people what all these costs are. It's kind of haphazard. So that's something for the future, too.
All right. Are we missing anything else from this coming meeting?
No, but I just want to thank WGXC again for being partners with us in their partner stream. And, you know, we're going to try to have every public meeting streamed through WGXC. And as you know, Tom, the streaming partner project is a great idea. It opens up government more. And who knows, maybe down the road we'll even have a video as well.
Yes. And so you can turn out or tune in to the informal Hudson Common Council meeting this coming Monday, which is January 11th, 12th, 13th, 13th? I think 13th.
Yeah, 13th.
At 7 p.m.
And as you know, you go to the Hudson Partner Stream webpage and click on the partner, and you can hear us live.
And have we got, I don't know if we've got any player embedded on the Hudson, on your City of Hudson website. We can get a player embedded so you can play it from there, too.
Oh, that's a great idea. Let me talk to the new...
yeah, we'll send you some code.
Yeah. At Michael Tremides, who's the new mayoral aide, and he's handling the website.
Yeah, so I'll talk to our technical infrastructure people, and we'll get you the code so it can be on the Hudson City of Hudson website, so you can just press play from there.
That's great. That's great, because that's where you also learn what meetings are actually taking place. Okay, thanks, Tom.
All right,
thank you. Appreciate it. And you know, next week I think we're going to get together again and talk before the formal meeting, and maybe we'll do this every month.
Yes,
be great.
That sounds great. Wonderful.
Okay.
Yes. So thank you for giving the public a preview of this Monday's Hudson Common Council meeting. Tom DiPietro, the Hudson Common Council president and also a WGXC volunteer programmer.
Hey, one last thing. At 10 o'clock this morning, if anybody's out there, there's the grand opening of the new Stewart's in the corner of Green and Fairview, and we're going to have a little ceremony in which they present us with their community host agreement check for $200,000, which is up to the Common Council to use as it will.
Wow. Okay. So that's 10 o'clock Monday.
No, today.
I mean, excuse me, Friday, January 10th.
Yep.
All right. So thank
you. Thanks, Tom.
All right. So have fun at Stewart's, and we'll talk to you later.
Yep.